Okay. Take your Bibles and turn to Micah. We're going to see if we can march through Micah 1 and 2 tonight. Last week we introduced Micah. And since last week our Bible study was very small, kind of like tonight, I don't know what's happened to our Monday or our Wednesday night crowds. Some of it I think is illness. But some of it's spring fever's wearing everybody out or something. I don't know. But Micah is broken down into three messages. Micah chapter 1 and verse 1 says that Micah's message, he was of Moresheth, it says in verse 1, in the days of Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah, kings of Judah. So his ministry spans three kings from about 750 B.C. to about 686. So we're looking at about 65 years of ministry that he's involved in. This, most Bible scholars recognize that the book of Micah is broken down into three speeches. Now, we look at it all as one book, but in reality, there are three speeches that are given probably, we don't know this for sure, but probably then at three times. Perhaps maybe each one or a speech is given, first speech given during the reign of one king, then the next during the next king, and then the next one during the last king. Each speech has this in common. This is what we kind of surveyed last week, is that it starts with a proclamation of God's judgment on Judah and Israel and ends with a proclamation of salvation, what God is going to do to save them. So, judgment, salvation, judgment, salvation, judgment, salvation. And that's the way each one of these goes. The first one, the one we're going to look at tonight, has the shortest section on salvation. It only has the last two verses of chapter 2. The second one, which starts in chapter 3 is the judgment section, and almost all of chapter 4 and chapter 5 are salvation section. And the last one, chapter 6 through the first half of chapter 7 is judgment. And then 7, 8 to the end of the chapter to verse 20 is salvation. So this first one has a very short salvation section on it. So we'll put in at verse 1. And I'm going to... So last week what we really did was we provided an overview. And I just kind of gave you a summary of that overview here tonight about that. What I'm going to try to do as we go through this is to try to bring out some things to... hopefully elaborate on some things that maybe aren't, well, there's a number of things that aren't obvious, although if you have a New American Standard and you read the marginal notes, that is the translator's notes that they put in their center margin in my Bible or at the foot of your Bible, a lot of those are helpful here because you have names that are connected with things going on, and the names are names of literal places. But you and I, we would just read the name and we would totally miss what it meant. It'd just be like saying, oh, that, and we don't know what that means. Okay? In other words, it would be to say, I hope that we have a heavenly and angelic experience when we go visit Los Angeles. Or I hope we hear messengers in Los Angeles. See? Now, I wouldn't have known that when I was growing up as a kid. Most of you know that, but as a dumb kid, I didn't know. Los Angeles is a city in California. But now I understand Los Angeles is Spanish for the angels. See? And so there's kind of a pun there playing on the messengers or angels with the city that you say Los Angeles. And so we miss some of this as we go through here. So it starts off then, we're going to put in at verse 2, it says, Hear, O peoples, all of you, and I'm reading through this whole thing verse by verse because I think it's the best way to cover this. Hear, O Israel, all peoples, O peoples, all of you, listen, O earth and all it contains, and let the Lord God be witness against you. Then we have this statement, He is witness against you, the Lord from His holy temple, referring to His temple in heaven, which then he's going to say, For behold, the Lord is coming forth from his place. What place is that? From his holy temple. Not the earthly one in Jerusalem, but the heavenly one, because it's where he's coming from. He will come down and tread on the high places of the earth. the mountains will melt under him. Now, we have this reference to mountains. This could be a literal statement. We could take this literally that he's going to come down and shake the earth violently and all that. But what is the metaphor that mountains in the Old Testament, especially in the prophets, often stands for?
Governments.
And the reason it was for governments is oftentimes when you had a regional area, well, it's kind of like, think of it like this way. We think of nations these days. But a good illustration of this is to go back to Persia and the pre-Greece state. So we were just talking about this last weekend with my uncle. If you've ever seen the movie The 300, never seen The 300.
Oh.
So okay. It's okay. It's not the greatest movie in the world. It is kind of over the top. What? It is a rough movie.
Is that Spartacus?
Yeah. Well, no, it's not Spartacus. It's about the Spartans. It's about the Spartans battling Xerxes, the king of Persia. It's based on a true account, historically, of what happened in the Battle of Thermopylae, where 300 Spartans held off the whole Persian army. And what it did was, you took a time when you had, the reason I'm reviewing all that, was at that time, if you ever remember Greek history when you're in high school and you studied world history, one of the things you learned about Greece was what called city-states. That is, you had a city, that was a state. You had another city over here, and it was a state. And that was the way it was. And you built cities in defensible positions because that was the center of your government. And everybody around there then, if you had an invasion, would all grab their animals if they were able, their families, and real precious belongings, and you'd all run inside, shut the gates of the city, and defend yourselves. Eventually what happens is they realize, you know what, if a bunch of us cities get together, we can form a nation and we can work to defend each other. And therefore you have nations that come out of that. Okay. And I'm not saying it took Greece was the first one, because Egypt, you had nations. You had nations before you had the nation of Greece and what happened with there. But that was an illustration of city-states. Okay. Well, when he's talking about this coming down against these mountains, he's looking at him coming down against them, these government powers, because these governments oftentimes built their cities, their defensible cities, up on top of hills or mountains to make them defensible. In fact, both of them that are going to be mentioned here in the passage are built on mountains or large hills. From our perspective, they're no Rainiers, okay? They're not even saddle mountains for that matter, technically. So, he says, the Lord is coming, verse 3, from his place. He will come down and tread on the high places of the earth. The mountains will melt under him. That is, these governments are going to melt. The valleys will split like wax before fire, like water poured down a steep place. He's looking at how just he comes down, he treads, everything just runs and pours before him. So you think of wax melting, you think of water being poured down a gully, and it just runs. That's the idea of how quickly this takes place. All of this is for the rebellion, or the Hebrew word here also can be used of transgression, which is important under the law, because transgression meant they were breaking the law. So the rebellion or the transgression of Jacob, remember Jacob being Israel's name before he wrestles with God. He's called Jacob. His mom and dad call him that. Heel grabber, usurper, heel overthrower. That switches when he wrestles with God, and God changes it from heel grabber to Israel, God's strong man, God's contender, God's wrestler. When you're looking at Jacob, you're looking at him as the rebel. To me, it is always really amazing when you go over to Romans 9, and it tells you in Romans 9 that God chose Jacob. It says, Jacob I've loved, Esau I've hated. And he says he did this before they'd done anything good or bad. Amazing thing about that is if you compare that account to Genesis, you don't see anything worthy in Jacob. The guy is a huckster. The guy's lazy. His brother's out doing work and he wants to hang out in tents. He doesn't seem like somebody that you would look at and say, boy, he's got moral character. He's our man. The one thing that he did, the one thing that did end up distinguishing him from his brother was that he had value on the birthright and value on the blessing, things which his brother, according to Hebrews, did not value. He was willing to sell his birthright for a bowl of soup or porridge. It's that desperate. But that shows you how little value he placed on it. It'd be like Ben being famished because he's been out for a long, long time, and he comes in, and he'd walk up here, and he'd say, "Oh, and I've got a bowl of soup." He'd walk up here, and he'd go, "Tim, you can have my house if you care. Or here's, can you give me the soup?" And I'd say, "Give me your house." "Okay, just give me the soup. I'm going to die." You guys would look at him and say, "You are insane."
I'm a glycemic.
I'd
always look at you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you'd look at Jacob and you think, man, you know, to trick your brother out of something like this. Exactly. That's exactly what's going on. So, verse 5 then, understand this, the rebellion of Jacob, looking at him as the rebel, it says, and for the sins of the house of Israel, now what is the rebellion or what is the transgression of Jacob? Is it not Samaria? Now, this is one of the things we talked about last week. We usually think of Samaria as being a whole northern area, a big place. And it did come to define a larger area. But I want you to take your Bibles and turn back to the book of 1 Kings. Find chapter 16 when you get back there. 1 Kings chapter 16. And I'm going to go to verse 23, and it said, in the 31st year of Asa, king of Judah, Omri became king over Israel. So we're looking in the north, and he became king 12 years. He reigned 6 years at Tirzah, and he bought the hill Samaria. Now notice that Samaria was a hill from Shemer. Now, this is very important because you missed this. If you have a New American Standard Bible, you're going to see that the Hebrew word for Samaria is literally Shomeron. Okay? If you have a good center column reference, if maybe you have another Bible. I just know the New American Standard does this for you. But Samaria, if you were literally were going to pronounce it, it's Shomeron. Then you come, he bought Shomeron from Shemer for 2 talents of silver. That's a lot of money, by the way. He built on the hill and named the city which he built, Samaria or Shomeron, after the name of Shemer. See where Samaria got its name from? Got its name from the man he bought the hill from. And he built a city on top of it. So he named it after the original owner of the hill. And then Omri did evil in the sight of the Lord, acted more wickedly than all who were before him. Do you remember what I shared with you on Sunday? That thing that Ed forwarded me, that note, where you see Ed was pointing out the relevance of these old things that you have, that lady at Exeter College or University of Exeter, that lecturer in religion, is saying that Jehovah had a wife, Asherah, because she's confusing the passages where Baal is equated with Jehovah. And he has an Asherah. And Omri, the king here that starts this, Omri, in her perspective, was a real king, and he was a good guy. David probably didn't even exist. It was probably a legend. David probably wasn't even real. But Omri, he's the real guy. And look at what Omri does. But here, according to the Bible, Omri's bad guy, does evil. Anyway, the reason we came over here is you see what Samaria is, okay? And you see that Samaria was a city on a hill, okay? Got that. Now go back to Micah. So it says, what is the rebellion or the transgression of Jacob? Is it not Samaria? What is the high place of Judah? Is it not Jerusalem? See, now we clearly understand Jerusalem's a city, but it's a city that represents the south. Samaria was a city that ended up representing the north. Verse 6, for I will make Samaria a heap of ruins in the open country, planting places for a vineyard. So he basically is going to level the city on that hill And rather than that hill being the place where a city sits, that hill's going to be a place where they're going to end up planting a vineyard. It'd be like if they rolled in to pick a city around here. You go to Othello. It's not a huge city around here, but it's big enough. Imagine if they came in there and just decided to bulldoze the whole thing and planted all the vineyards, put it into orchard. But that's with his point here. The city is going to be judged by him and turned into farmland. I will pour her stones down into the valley. Stones being what they used to build a city out of, obviously. I will lay bare her foundations. All of her idols, because that's what those guys did, all those people up in Samaria, they were idol worshippers, they were Baal worshippers. All of her idols will be smashed, because they're stone, most of them. All of her earnings will be burned with fire. So everything that she gets that pertains to those idols, all of her images I will make desolate. Now notice you have idols smashed, earnings burned with fire, and then images made desolate. And she collected them, these things, from her harlot earnings. That is, she acted as a harlot by going after these other gods. Very reminiscent of what we saw in Hosea. And to the earnings of a harlot they will return. Which is telling us that the idols, the earnings, and the images are all talking about, even the earnings back up there, most likely are talking about things that they are getting with respect to idols. They're somehow or another earning or winning idols. Goes on, verse 8. Because of this, I must lament. This is Micah now. I must lament and wail. In other words, this did not make him happy. He was very sad about what was happening in the north. As a result, I go barefoot and naked. Now, if you watch somebody going around like that, you definitely would think something's the matter.
With them, yeah.
Yeah, something was the matter with them. But what that is it's a demonstration of this immense state of grief that he's in. Now, again, whether he means naked in the sense that he's literally bare, or whether it means that he's stripped of your formal outer garments and that he's wearing perhaps just a wrap or just a light undergarment, which you did not wear as you went about in public, is also a possibility. We don't know for sure. All we know is one way or another, he's not dressed in what you would. In other words, if you came to my house and I showed up at the door in my t-shirt and underwear, or you saw me walking next door, you would say, well,
hey, Brother Jim.
You would say, well, at least he has something on, it's more appropriate, but you'd still say it's not, still not appropriate. And that's the point. Hope you understand here when he's talking about this. However, whatever the nakedness refers to, it's not appropriate, and it's showing his greed. I must make...
Is it a Hebrew word just for naked?
Yeah, or stripped. So you can be stripped in different ways. So you can be stripped down to your, you know...
Can I make a comment?
Verse 8 of chapter 1. Yes, you may.
When you introduce verse 3, it's back up there again. Look, the Lord is coming from his dwelling place. He comes down and treads the high places of the earth. You asked us what are high places. Peggy mentioned government. I know it is referred to, or mountaintops are referred to as government. I was thinking of kind of if you're studying Hosea. It seems like in context, it also would. You have Samaria, which is a hill, and you have Jerusalem, which is a hill. So there seems to be a governmental city connection there. I was thinking, though, high places like Hosea, that was an idolatry worship. You know, that's where they erected their altars. That's where they were behaving in immoral ways that you've talked about. And then verse 7 really confirms all our idols were broken to pieces. So a lot of those high places, obviously connected with that idolatry.
At the end of verse 3, it says he will come down and tread on the high places of the earth. And then verse 4, the mountains will melt under him. So the mountains are the governments. The high places are broader than that, yes. They're not absolutely identical.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I didn't make that clear when we went through there. I jumped right into the mountains, and I didn't take time to go on and elaborate on the more broad meaning of the high places.
Was Samaria and Jerusalem involved? I always kind of, I don't know geography, obviously, archaeology, but I always kind of pictured these high places being, you know, out a little bit.
Yeah, well, Samaria was, because Samaria was the city up on this hill, and yes, they did have in Samaria up there on that hill, they did have idol worship going on up there in the north. I was going to say Omri does this. Ahab does this.
First Kings passage.
Right. So they have idols up there. In addition to other high places around the country, they do have them there. And also, eventually, Jerusalem will too. Because when Ezekiel writes, God's telling Ezekiel that he's going to bring judgment on all this. And so then Ezekiel gets to see this just horrible vision where everybody at the temple is going through all the motions worship of Jehovah. And in reality, it's all idol worship. One of the things that you had an indication of is that people were going up around the temple and were up around the area of the temple bearing idols out around the temple area. Why? So that when they went to the temple, they could go through the motions of worshiping Jehovah, but in their minds, I'm worshiping my little idol that's just right out over here. See? So they're compromising, which is the same thing the north did. We saw that in Hosea, where they looked at the worship of Jehovah and they said, it's Baal, it's Jehovah. They called Baal Jehovah. Imagine that. I mean, it would just be an insult. I mean, if I came home and my wife had taken up with another man in the context of Hosea and was calling that other man by my name. Number one, it's an insult she's taken up with another man. Sorry, pick on you, honey. But number two, it would be even more insulting if she just decided to call him my name. Like I wasn't even around. Do you get the point? That's just like a double slap in the face. And that's what they did in the north with Jehovah. Because they took Jehovah and they said, hey, yeah, we're worshiping Jehovah. When in reality, they're worshiping Baal. Is that explanation? So the high places do refer to more than just the governments, yes. Okay, then back down to verse 8. So, again, it says, because of this I must lament and wail, I must go barefoot and naked, I must make a lament like the jackals. So you think how jackals laugh. If you ever watch nature shows in Africa and you listen to the way those things go, that is one creepy little sound that they make. It's kind of, but you know, we don't know what's going on. You guys maybe hear the coyotes out here a lot, but we've heard them for years in the orchard out behind our place, but they have been so close this spring, and man, they get going out there, and if you go, I run out back and stand out back on the back steps so I can hear them really well, and man, it is weird. It sounds like they talk to each other, the noise that they make. It's not just kind of yipping and barking. There's all different kinds of tones and stuff going on, and it's just, anyway, I'm thinking of that when I'm thinking of the lament of the jackals, because these guys, these coyotes back there, kind of remind me a little bit of that with the way they yip back and forth. So also the mourning like ostriches, which I'm going to have to plead ignorant on that because I don't exactly know what kind of noises ostriches make or what they do. But it says, verse 9, for her wound is incurable, for it has come to Judah, it has reached the gate of my people, even to Jerusalem. So he's saying what's happened in the north has become so severe that even down here in Judah, the people that were more loyal, in Jerusalem where the temple was located, this problem is even there. So you picture a wound that gets started and it doesn't heal and it doesn't cure, but it actually begins to spread. It begins to spread. I don't know, flesh-eating disease or something that bacteria gets into to a wound. I don't know if you've ever seen like wounds from spider bites. I'm sure in their day they knew of people that would get wounded, and because they didn't always understand sepsis and things like that, they didn't always know how to treat. I shouldn't say they weren't. They certainly weren't ignorant, but there were some things that they didn't know about wounds, and so the problems in those wounds just get more. They would never heal; just get worse and worse and worse and worse. Until a person eventually lose a limb.
And what is the wound?
It's connected with, I believe, the idol worship and everything. If you remember, Isaiah, when he comes, in fact, we're going to have a section here in Micah that is going to be identical to about five verses in Isaiah. Okay? We're not going to get to it tonight. It'll be next week. But five verses that are almost totally identical in the Hebrew. Because they're writing, Micah and Isaiah are writing at the same time. They're contemporaries. They're both prophesying at the same time. And Isaiah, when God introduces his indictment against Israel and Judah through Isaiah, he says that you're sick. The whole, you are sick from the top of your head down to the sole of your foot. In other words, he looked at the fallen state as an illness, uncorrected, untended. Okay? Now, with that, then, he goes down to verse 11. He says, do not tell it at Gath. Weep not at all. And literally, this expression, weep not at all, is literally to weep, don't weep. That's what literally the word weep occurs twice in there. Once is an infinitive, and then once is an imperfect. So to weep, don't weep. And then we start getting into these expressions, which I have to start pointing some of these things out. By the way, Gath was a city of the Philistines, but Gath was a wine press. It was a place where you pressed things out. And what we think of that...
It was a city that had a wine press in it.
That's what the name Gath meant. So there probably at one time was a major wine press there, which is probably where it got its name.
Okay.
What
is a Philistine?
It was a Philistine city.
Okay.
Remember, Goliath was from Gath. Goliath and his four brothers were from Gath. But when you pressed a grape, it expressed juice when you pressed them out, which was akin to it weeping. And then that would leak out this thing. And so it's like, do not speak this. Do not reveal this. Do not relate this in Gath. To weep, do not weep. Do not, in other words, the very thing that you think a wine press is supposed to do, don't do it. No weeping. Which is what they looked at when you were making the grapes give up their juice was causing them to weep. Then you come to the next. So this, all of this is all play on words in here. And you miss it because you have to see it in the Hebrew. Okay, or you have to have a Bible that at least has these notes. So next one we have this Beth, which is house, El, or Beth La Ephrah, which is, it says, at Beth La Ephrah, roll yourself in the dust. Literally, it's house of the dust, roll in the dust. That's what he's getting at here when he talks about this. And again, if you have a marginal note on verse 10, it should say, house of the dust. I should follow these. So, in case you have a New American Standard, so you can see all these.
What does house of the dust represent?
What?
What does house of the dust represent?
That's what Beth La Ephrah is.
Okay.
That's what it means. That's the name of a city.
Okay. So
and it's called House of the Dust.
House of the Dust, roll yourself in the dust.
Well, see, rolling in the dust was one of the things you did when you were in a major state of grief.
Oh, yeah, okay.
You rolled in the dust.
Mm-hmm.
You picked up, remember when Job's friends came, they picked up dust and threw dust in the air and threw dust on their heads.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then you come to the next one, verse 11. Here, I've got these in my notes, but I'm trying to follow them out of the American Standard. So it says, go on your way, inhabitants of Shafir, literally which is beautiful or pleasant, in shameful nakedness. In other words, could you imagine if you had something that was absolutely just beautiful or gorgeous and you stripped it and sent it out shamefully? In other words, the very thing that it should show, you're not going to let it show. That's the contrast between the beautiful to be shamefully naked, to miss the whole point of what he means. And that's what Shafir meant, beautiful or very pleasant. Then we have this word, inhabitant of Zaanan, does not escape. And literally, they've translated this word escape at the end of this statement in verse 11, but literally it's the inhabitant of city of going out, or the place of going out, does not go out. Zion is a word to go out, or literally Yatzan in this case. So in other words...
It doesn't mean to go out as an escape?
Well, I think that's why they translate it as an escape here. They're translating it as an escape, but the word just means to go out. But they're trying to... But the translators are trying to represent what they think was meant by you're coming under judgment, and the very city of going out, you're not going to go out. Yeah, a ton of them down through here. And it does this all the way through the book. You have these things. The lamentation, literally here, of Beth Etzel. And Beth Etzel is literally house of nearness. House of nearness, or the house beside, house of closeness.
House of removal.
House of removal. Really?
Yeah.
Let me look in here. 11, see, I haven't looked at this. Oh, yours says house of removal. No, see, when I was researching this, Beth Etzel was actually, I flip over my other page notes, on to the next page here. It's Etzel is supposed to be house of closeness. I'm not for sure why they could do that. Because I consulted two commentaries, and they both have Etzel, and my Greek dictionary has Etzel as nearness. Because then you have the next part of it, which says, he will take from you, that is, from this house of closeness, your standing. In other words, you're the one that's close. The idea of close in this context means a thing perhaps close to lean on, which is why they've translated, the New American Standard has translated the word standing as support. The very thing you lean on, the thing that's close for you to lean on, it's been pulled out. You're leaning on it, pull it out from underneath you. Okay? You know how that is. You know, your friends used to do that. You know, you'd lean like this, and they'd come up, knock your arm out from underneath you, do stuff like that.
Pull your up from behind you before you sit down.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's exactly what's being pictured here. Verse 12, for the inhabitant of Merah, that is the inhabitant of bitterness, becomes weak waiting for a good thing because calamity has come down from the Lord to the gate of Jerusalem. In other words, it's a city of bitterness. They're waiting for something good, and they're not going to get anything good. They're just going to get disaster. That's what he's getting at. So he says, harness the chariot to the team of horses, O inhabitant of Lachish. Now he tells us something about Lachish here, and this is the only place you find this. You don't find information having gone through the occurrences of this word in the Old Testament. You don't find any that explain it. But it says, she was the beginning of sin to the daughter of Zion. In other words, this is apparently, Lachish is apparently where they began to introduce this idol worship in the south. Because in you were found the rebellious acts of Israel. That is the things that Israel did. That's where this transgression started for them.
Then he says she was the beginning of sin to the daughter of Zion.
Oh, okay. This is another expression. Daughter of Zion is oftentimes, it's a, you have daughters of Israel, daughters of Jerusalem, usually is referring to the city itself or the little satellite communities that were around it, is what it was used for. So they use daughter oftentimes for the little satellite towns. Because as you remember, we have Jerusalem, and then outlying around Jerusalem a mile or two out, we have different cities. Remember Bethany? Where they were staying, Jesus's. I had friends that were in Bethany outside Jerusalem. Bethany's about two miles, I think, out of Jerusalem. Having never been there, I guess that's what it is, from what I understand.
So and, wait, not a satellite, but a suburb.
Sort of a suburb, but they're separated. The city doesn't go out. They actually kind of go through some country. That's why we kind of call them a satellite city out there. And those were the places that the people would run inside the walled city when there was war. He goes on now in verse 14. So you got that with the daughters. Because that expression occurs a lot throughout the Minor Prophets. The daughters of, and it names the city, and the daughters of this. And it's talking about these small communities that surround these cities.
Mm-hmm.
Verse 14, therefore, you will give literally a parting gifts, and this parting gifts or sending away gifts is an expression that was used of sending a dowry. But you're going to send a dowry on behalf of, we have this Moresheth Gath. And this here Moresheth is a possession. You're going to send a gift in this case for the place that is a gift or the place that is a possession. It's not the same word as gift up there.
So Moresheth is gift?
It's possession, literally. A place possessed. This one does this. They don't define this for you.
Possession.
Yeah, the place of possession.
Place of possession?
Yeah. Okay.
And Gath was?
Goes back to the wine press.
Wine press, yeah.
So in other words, the point is, the very possession, you're giving a gift away from it. You know, hey, I look at this great stuff I gave. Give some of that away. That's what he'd be saying. You get the point? I've got all these possessions. You're going to take some of it away and you're going to give it away on behalf of that city. See, that, in other words, all these things are play on words that he's trying to show what he's going to do. Next we come to this, the houses of Akzib, literally deception, become a deception. The word deception, we have Akzib, And I'm not saying that. I can't see, my writing is too small.
Is it a city or is it a...
We have Akzib, and then we have Akzub. Akzib and Akzub. They're the same. So we have the city, Akzib, and which is a place of deception, and then the city, Deception.
What's
it? You know how that city got the name Deception?
I don't. I don't know what the background it is. The word Akzib is the same word as the word deception at the end of the line.
Yeah.
Except, well, it's Akzib and Akzub. There's just one little letter that's dropped out.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
Verse 15, moreover, I will bring on you the one who takes possession, O inhabitant of Marishah. Same word, another form of the word that was used back up in verse 14, inhabitant of the possession. And then it says, and the glory of Israel will enter Adullam. Now, Adullam is the place where David went and hid in a cave. So it was a place of hiding. So the idea here is that the glory of Israel is going to go into hiding, just like David did. That was the significance of Adullam. It was the place where David. And so he says, so make yourselves bald and cut off your hair. Now, again, we don't appreciate this because as guys, we wear our hair short. You look at Ed, he wears his hair short. Ben wears his hair short. Mine's short. But in their culture, Jewish men wore their hair long. Okay, women wore their hair really long, and men wore their hair long. Remember, David's son, Absalom, had hair that was so long that it got caught entangled in a tree, and it held him there while his mount walked out from underneath him, and he's left hanging by his hair. That's a lot of hair. Same. To cut your hair off or to be bald was a sign that you had failed. It was a sign of grief. In fact, last year when George and Debbie had gone over to Israel over their spring break, I asked George, because I look at George and I'm always thinking, George could pass for a Jewish guy. And I said, I bet you just been over. You probably just look like the Jewish guys, you know, his build and his kind of his face and everything dark hair. And he goes, no. He says, I'd never pass for a Jewish guy. I said, really? He goes, yeah, I'm bald. He says, Jewish guys aren't bald. I said, seriously. He says, they all have thick heads of hair. This must be something in their Jewish genes. So anyway, to make yourself bald or to cut your hair was a sign that you were a failure or a sign that you're in grief. Because of the children of your delight, extend your baldness like that of the eagle. In other words, really shave it back. For they, referring to your children, will go from you into exile. Your children are going to be taken away from you and you're not going to see them. So it's a real time to grieve. Question.
Okay, so we're talking to... He's talking to...
Israel and Judah back up in the context. If you go back up to... we had Samaria and...
Jerusalem.
I lost my place in Jerusalem. End of verse 5.
Okay.
So, come to chapter 2.
Can I have one thing real quick?
Yes.
I was not reading fast enough in verse 11. I missed the plain language there.
It says the inhabitant of Meroth, which is bitter.
In verse 11?
Verse 11. I'm sorry. Verse 11 says, go on your way, inhabitant of Shafir, which is beautiful or pleasant.
Okay.
But go away not in beauty or pleasant, but go away in shameful nakedness.
Okay.
These are all real places.
Yeah. Yes, they were all.
But some of them, they're all outside of Jerusalem and Samaria.
Yeah, they're all in that region of Israel and Judah.
Okay. So, the context this sin of Judah and Samaria, or probably of Jerusalem and Samaria, is spreading. I guess they are in Israel and Judah, so they are in the God's chosen people. But the sin is spreading.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, that's why there's always plenty of in contrast. And what should be is not.
And or what the name of this place is, God plays off that word because this is what's going to happen to you because of your sin. because of what he's going to do, because he's going to come out of his place and tread down the high places and cause the mountains to melt. Yes.
So it should be pleasant in Shafir, which means fuzzy, but it's not going to be.
Yeah. In other words, think of it, verse 11, beautiful as Shafir. You got a knockout gorgeous wife, and they come in at a raiding party, and she's laying in bed, and her hair's all a mess. I'm putting this in modern terms, the way people do today. She doesn't have a chance to put on her nice clothes, put her makeup on or anything, and she's got to run out there in her ragged old nighty thing that she sleeps in, her pajamas or sweats or whatever it is, and goes out running, and you're going, there's nothing beautiful about that. That's the point. There's nothing beautiful about it. It's supposed to be beautiful, but there's nothing beautiful. Okay. I don't know if that's a good illustration or not, but that's kind of the punch. He's talking about going out in shameful nakedness. Okay.
So this was fulfilled in the
exile. It's actually going to be fulfilled in two different things. And that's one of the problems. We introduced this last week with Micah. Part of this will be fulfilled in God's judgment with the north, with Assyria. And part of it's going to be fulfilled in the exile to Babylon. And some people go, well, it's too early for it to be predicting the exile of Babylon. Why? The only reason you say it's too early is for people that can't think that God could predict Babylon before Babylon, because some of these prophecies are being made before Babylon is actually a significant power. God can do that. God talks about the people of Rome in one sense before the people of Rome. He mentions Greece by name in the book of Daniel before Greece is a power that's going to threaten them. He mentions Cyrus by name. What is it, 120 years before Cyrus is in power? Before he's born, he's mentioned in Isaiah. So God can do these kind of things. So yes. But we kind of touched on those last week. Now, chapter 2. See if we can kind of move quickly through some of these things. Get bogged down just a little bit less. It says, woe to those then who scheme iniquity, who work out evil on their beds, and when morning comes they go and do it. You get the idea. They're laying up all night thinking stuff. For it is in the power of their hands. They covet fields, and they seize. Houses, they take away. In other words, they covet the fields, they covet the houses. They literally oppress a man and his house, a man and his inheritance. New American Standard has translated this rob, but literally it's they've oppressed. But they're oppressing for the purpose, obviously, because in verse 1, they covet, they want to get it. So that's why they put him under some sort of an oppression so that they can get this thing. The very thing, remember, that Ahab did to get Naboth's vineyard, oppressed him, made him, brought guilt on an innocent man so that he could have him killed so he could steal his land. Verse 3, therefore, thus says the Lord, behold, I'm planning against you this family of calamity from which you cannot remove your necks. And we have the word remove here, and we're going to have remove again down in verse 4, it's going to come up the same word. You will not walk haughtily, for it will be an evil time. So he's looking at putting a heavy weight on their necks, and so you're not going to be able to walk around with your head up like this, because you're going to have this heavy burden on the back of your necks that's going to keep you from doing it. Verse 4, on that day they will take up against you a taunt, and they will utter a bitter lamentation and say, we are completely destroyed. He exchanges the portion of my people's. How he removes, that is the portion, from me. And that remove is the same word in verse 3. You can't remove the calamity, but he removes the portion. The thing that is significant, the thing you want, he takes away. To the apostate, he apportions our fields. That is to the people that weren't Jews, weren't loyal.
That's what apostate is.
An apostate normally is considered to be an infidel, a person that is broken. Totally broken. We in Christianity use apostate for a person that's broken faith. They're using it for a person that has nothing to do with them at all. Verse 5. Therefore, you will have no one stretching a measuring line. Stretching of the measuring line had to do with property. It's the way you measured out your line. And remember back up in what he was talking about up in verse 1? They want land. They wanted houses. They wanted these things. They're going to go out and divide them up. But no. Once this calamity comes, there's going to be no one stretching a measuring line for you by lot in the assembly of the Lord, because you stretched a measuring line to see who got what property. There's no one to do it. Do not speak out. So they speak out. Look at this. Very thing they shouldn't do. If they do not speak out concerning these things, reproaches will not be turned back. It is being said, O house of Jacob, is the spirit of the Lord impatient? Are these his doings? Do not my words do good to the one walking uprightly? In other words, he's trying to say, what? Is the Spirit getting impatient with us? And God's saying, listen, my words do good for those who walk upright. Obviously, if you guys are going to get calamity, it's an indication you're not walking upright. And it's not that the Spirit is impatient. He'd actually given them time. It's the very reason he'd sent them prophets, was to encourage them to change. Recently, verse 8, my people have arisen as an enemy. You strip the robe off the garment from unsuspecting passersby. See, the people that were supposed to be nice guys were supposed to look out in the law for the person that passes through your land. They were not supposed to have a heavy hand towards them. They were supposed to treat the stranger well as the poor in the land. But here, someone passing through the land, they rise up and they strip the clothes off them from the unsuspecting ones, from those who return from war. The very people that have gone to fight for war, then you take advantage of them. The women of my people, you evict them. Kick them out of their houses. Each one from her pleasant house. From her children, you take my splendor forever. They're stealing. Again, it sounds again a lot like what we were looking at last time we were in Hosea. Arise and go, for this is no place of rest, because of the uncleanness that brings on destruction, a painful destruction. If a man walking after wind and falsehood had told lies, and said, I will speak out to you concerning wine and barley beer, he would be a spokesman to this people. A beer vendor is your spokesman. Okay. The seller of liquor. And that word liquor is one of the words that was used of things that they were supposed to, that the priests were supposed to avoid. Okay, and they translate liquor, but it's a word that literally refers to beer, and specifically barley beer that was brewed from barley in this context. Verse 12, I will surely then assemble all of you, Jacob. I will surely gather the remnant of Israel. Now this is the salvation part. I will put them together like sheep in the fold, like a flock in the midst of its pasture. They will be noisy with men. So he's looking at a time in which he's going to gather them up. He's talked about sending them away. All of the sections, sending you out. You're going to be taken away. Your children are going into exile. Now he's saying, but I will gather all of you, Jacob. That's what surely is. I will surely gather. We in English say, I surely gather. Literally, it's to gather, I gather. Literally, you have the verb twice, once as an infinitive and once as a regular verb. Gather the remnant of Israel. So he's gathering the remnant, and he's bringing them like sheep back to the sheepfold. But they're going to go out to pasture from there, and so then we have, verse 13, we had a little question about this one, but we have a participle at the first part that says, the one breaking goes up before them.
What's the noisy with? They will be noisy with men.
In other words, there's going to be enough of a remnant that sheepfold is going to, there's going to be a lot of people. In other words, okay. Well, that's noisy out there with people.
Okay, so it's going to be a big remnant or a good
number. Yeah, there'll be a good-sized remnant that he's going to be bringing back. And then verse 13, we have three references here to the Lord Jesus Christ. He is, first of all, the first participle in there, the breaker, the one breaking, literally. The breaker, the one breaking, goes up before them. Now, you know, we don't quite get what he means by that yet, but we will in a second. And then they break out. Same word, but it's talking about what they do. They pass through the gate and they go out by it. So their king goes on before them and the Lord at their head. Now, what's he picturing the remnant as? In these sheep in the flock. Mm-hmm. Who takes care of sheep? And how does a shepherd take care of sheep?
He leads
them. So we have the one that literally he brings them back. They're confined. And then he's the one that breaks. There may be more to this concept of breaking, but as I understand it, he breaks them out of the confines that he has to bring them back into. And then they, too, follow him, and they, too, break out. They don't stay behind as he goes out then. He breaks the way, and then they break out with him. They pass through the gate, and they go out by it because back up in verse 12, it's talking about that there's the sheep that are going to be in the midst of this pasture. They're in the sheepfold, but eventually pasture. You don't want to keep them in the sheepfold because then you got to bring food to them. You take them out of the sheepfold so they can go out to pasture. And then, so their king goes on before them. So now it tells us that the one breaking, the one that's leading them, is actually going to be their king. And it says, and the Lord, or Jehovah, at their head. So this person, this king, implied in the context, the one breaking, is Jehovah himself. Jehovah's going to be their shepherd. Now we know this from other scriptures, that they're going to have one shepherd, and it's going to be the Lord. It's going to be their Messiah. That's what this is getting at. Now chapters 4 and 5 are going to be a long extended section on salvation, and chapters 4 and 5 are going to really elaborate on this king, this Lord, this Messiah that's coming. But in this context here, as he tells us this just very quickly, he's just trying to say very simply, he's going to be the one that's going to break him out. He's going to go before them as king, and he's going to be their Jehovah. He's not going to have somebody beneath him being this. He himself is going to be this shepherd. He himself is going to be the one that's going to regather them, going to be the one that's going to assemble them. And he's the one that's going to then lead them. So all of this, they've ventured out, they've gone astray, they've done their thing in this context. They've been taking advantage of people. They've been scheming against people. That's one of the reasons they're going to be punished. The main focus of the punishment back in chapter 1 was the idolatry. The focus of the punishment in chapter 2 has to do with the fact that they're taking advantage again of the poor. Or taking advantage maybe not just of the poor, but maybe just the average Joe. And that's the background of why they're going to be punished. But he ends in verses 12 and 13 by reminding them it's not always going to be like this. There is going to be a time in which there's going to be a reassembling, there's going to be a regathering, and there's going to be one that's going to lead you. That's going to be, we say it's their Messiah, but there's obviously your King, Jehovah. Okay.
So that Lord, like capital, all capitalized. So
that's the way the New American Standard represents the name Jehovah,
okay.
Distinct from Adonai, which they spell with lowercase.
Okay. So in this case, does it always refer to Christ?
No, it doesn't always refer to Christ, but it does in this, because he's leading them as their shepherd.
Yeah.
Something that the Father doesn't do, but something Christ does.
So that's not too different. So their king goes on before them and the Lord at their head, that's not too different.
No, they're all references to roles that he is playing. Well, not roles that he's playing, but breaker is a role, king is a role, and the person who it is Jehovah. If you want to, just let me find this here real quick.
While you're looking for that, I was going to say, my concordance says, Micah's, dealing with verses 12 and 13 there. Micah's prophecy telescopes two great events. Judah's return from captivity in Babylon, which is what you were talking about. And the great gathering of all believers when the Messiah returns.
Oh, well, when the Messiah returns, it's going to be a regathering of Israel. Is what it's going to be. It's not going to be a regathering of all believers. It's going to be more specific than that in this context.
He's breaking the chains of captivity. Is that what the breaker means? It's so funny. Do you remember that pastor from Ghana? Pastor Jackson. He did a speech on this thing 10 years ago. I shouldn't say that, but it's like, waters, and the breaker has come. And this is my mail.
Yeah, and what he's going to do is he's literally going to break. He's going to break the captivity that's going to happen in the future is what he's going to do. Because right now, even most of Israel is still in a state of exile. So that's what he has to break. What were you saying, Peter?
Oh, so it's not going to be breaking out of the sheepfold.
Well, it's breaking out of the confines that they've been in.
Right. He's going to gather them like a sheep in a sheepfold.
Right, and then lead them out to the pasture.
Out of. Okay.
In other words, there is an interesting parallel in this idea to what you have in John 10, where he says, I have other sheep. He says, I'm the good shepherd. And he says, what he does is he protects the sheep in the sheepfold, but he says, I am the door of the sheep, and by me the sheep come in, but they also go in and out and find pasture. See? You don't find pasture in the sheepfold. Mm-hmm. Sheepfold is strictly for protection. The pasture is where they're fed, so you have to take them out of the sheepfold for them to eat.
So the sheepfold is not what they're breaking out of.
No, no.
It's the bondage.
It's, yes. That's
okay, I had a really dumb question. Say, why weren't you listening? When is this happening?
I would state that this is happening at the end of Daniel's 70th week.
So where's David in all this?
David's not delivering them. When they go into the millennial kingdom, David will be a shepherd king under Christ, but he's not
so
delivering
why
them.
Isn't he the king there, and the Lord is the actual head? Why isn't David the
because
king?
This is him going before them, leading them, and David doesn't lead them out of captivity. David doesn't lead them out of captivity. Christ is the one that leads them out of captivity. David, once they go into the kingdom, David will come and rule. But not until the kingdom. He doesn't.
That and is kind of like the Greek chi, even the Lord at their head?
I would take it as an ascensive idea in this case. Which I think I even have written down in my notes, if I remember correctly. Okay, anything else? Any other questions?
These are interesting verses because it's a pretty weird book, to be honest. I've read it a long time. But these verses are in the charismatic world applied to us.
The idea of the breaker, the breaking?
Yeah, it's the idea of looking to break with the Lord. I mean, it's said in a way that it's not necessarily intentionally trying to mislead you, but you know when God's called the breakers? It's like, I want to call the breaker. Lead the way. Break the way. Bust me out. You know? But, it's just a different context.
Now, I wasn't aware that there were people that took it that sense, so I'm not familiar with that.
Is your front light on? Somebody's here.
Okay, well, let's close here with a word of prayer then if there's no other questions. Father, we're thankful for the evening, for your word, and even these passages such as this, that while they are not something that is really applicable to where we are at today, we're not living under this situation. We are not Israel or Judah. They certainly are reminders to us of the fact that you take quite seriously the unrighteous activity of your people, Israel, and you still take quite seriously our unrighteous activity. And you may not take us into exile or the captivities that they were being promised, but we just are thankful that we're able to have an appreciation for what you're going to do with your people, Israel, and that even in that state of judgment, you will eventually cause them to return, cause them to be regathered out of their exile. And we thank you for it. Amen.